Welcome to our podcast.
If you enjoy this segment, we encourage you to check out the others. Also, if you're new to Hedgeye, you qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's mmoran@hedgeye.com.
I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back. This one's going to be good, all right? We've had some very good conversations over the years. The one and only Raul Paul, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here as ever.
Yeah, the man on content this year, man. If I had an MVP award in terms of content that's helping educate and make people money, save people money, make people money, you get that award for 2020. You guys have just crushed it. Congratulations on everything that you've built.
Thanks so much, Keith. It really means a lot.
It's impressive. So the first question I was asked you is like, what the fuck is up with these Bitcoin people?
You are so stupid. Why did you shake the hornet's nest? You think it's amusing. It won't leave you for ages now. I mean, I never forget when I sold Bitcoin in the run up. I thought I was a hero, right? I bought it at 200, sold it at 2,500. I felt like a god. It went up to 20,000 and they relentlessly called me an idiot for about 3 years. You didn't need to do that. You see, because what you're doing here, and you know, it's actually very a good investing lesson is time horizons. These guys are looking at long-term time horizons, which is why the holding thing. So when anybody trades around it, they don't get it because it's different mismatches of time horizons.
I was just having I think today I said I sold my DraftKings. I mean, another day I said I shorted Citigroup. I just typed it, man, and all of a sudden I got this. These people are fucking nuts, some of these people. You got to admit that, right? Not every one of these people, these hodlers, are normal.
No, they're not. But, you know, I had an issue with how kind of aggressive that community is, right? And I spoke to somebody else about it, and they said, look, it's a feature of the community itself, is, you know, they're trying to strive for the adoption of something new, so they're going to fight for it. And, you know, good on them, but yeah, it's pretty tough.
I like it, because I want to actually use it. And what I'm still trying to learn on the fly here, and I wanted to get your help with it, because I know that you, like me, are a go-anywhere type of a person, whether it be gold or Bitcoin. Like, I'm not married to these bloody positions. I don't think that you feel like you're getting into any kind of promiscuous new relationship with something here. Like, I just want to try to crest, and I have figured this out. There are plenty of people that bought Bitcoin when I did. By the way, I bought it and sold it multiple times in my life. This is the only time I ever made the proclamation of what I actually did with full transparency, as I would. You know, but at the end of the day, I mean, is it truly and uniquely a one and only strategy with one duration, and you don't have the open mind to buy anything else?
I mean, look, I actually just buy and hold it. I don't do anything with it. I store it on a device. I don't trade it. I don't do anything. So I'm actually of the opinion, my time horizon for this is, you know, I think there's a 5-year event to play out here, and I'll probably trade within 18 months. So I might take some profits if I get some, you know, if I get the kind of profits that I think. But I think the opportunity is so big that I'm not interested in the wiggles. Mm-hmm. But again, different people trade it in different ways.
Well, I've always, to be clear, I mean, I think that the opportunity in everything I do is tremendously huge, right? I mean, let's just assuming that we take a position in anything, let's just go all Trumpian on it. I mean, what I've always thought, if I use my process and gold goes from 1,200 to 1,700, I want to make not 500, I want to make 700, 800. I want to use options. I want to augment my big position with bigger returns than what I would have just bought and hold and made in it.
Yeah, it's doable. The problem is with Bitcoin, it's extremely volatile. It's all skewed to the upside, really. You know, the downside spikes can be sharp and brutal. They tend not to last very long, and the upside spikes, it almost gives you no chance to ever get back in again. You know, having been involved with Bitcoin since 2011, it's bloody hard if you get out of a position. It doesn't actually trade like most. I mean, Darius talks this about it a lot. It's like he can't get to grips with the fact, you know, on Twitter, of how this trades as a macro instrument. As you pointed out, there is a passing correlation to several other asset prices right now. So, you know, you've been looking for the dollar to rally, and obviously Bitcoin should come off a bit, and that kind of makes sense. But over a longer run, it actually doesn't match almost anything else. And it doesn't trade in the same way. So it's not a straightforward instrument to trade, I find. Other people love trading it. I tend not to.
See, I find that, I mean, and again, I've used my process, which is, you know, the Bitcoin community, whether, and again, we have a lot of, I have a lot of subscribers to our process that own it as well, and they're not as viscerally affected by my tweet. But there is an absolute overlay with Quad 4 happening and me getting to buy a shitload of Bitcoin at a lower price. So even if you did believe that there was no correlation, but you didn't know what the quads were, you know, you've said this yourself. I was looking at some of your tweets recently, and you say, well, all but this one time, which is November of 2018, this kind of a vol situation was, you know, something to be bought in Bitcoin. Well, that was actually one of the biggest calls that I've made against the crowd, which was Quad 4 and Q4 of 2018. And that's where you could have bought a lot of Bitcoin. So I'm just trying to introduce like something to a community of people that if they truly are, you know, of the mindset that you are to hold this, wouldn't you want to know the impact of Quad 4 and what it can do to Bitcoin? It did it again in Q2 of 2020.
Yeah, and I actually question the premise of how big the effect will be on Quad 4, because the deflationary bias that comes in that period of time is, I think, in the end, actually much more bullish for Bitcoin and gold,
yep,
than it is bearish. So I understand that the liquidation that comes from this kind of move comes and can be meaningful, but the reality is we know the answer to a deflationary bias within the markets is going to be more QE. And once Bitcoin and gold start looking through, I think they start going up regardless of what the dollar's doing, for example, regardless of what bond yields are doing.
Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, for people that don't know what the quads are, Quad 4 is the only quad. That's when you have deflation, to Raul's point. You have both the rate of change of real growth and of inflation falling at the same time. It's the only economic quadrant where the dollar goes up. You know, so that's why it currently has a trending correlation of 0.88 inverse correlation to Bitcoin, in as much as it has a 0.92 of against gold. Now, what do you think about that? Like, a lot of the feedback I've gotten is, well, if I go to 26 weeks, that doesn't exist. I mean, for me, I don't get up in the morning for 26 weeks. You do on this position, well, which is totally different holding period.
Yeah, but so it really depends on, again, it's just time horizons, right? I have no issue with you trading around it because I have a longer term time horizon. And I'm just happy, you know, I'll just buy more if it sells off. And I'm not particularly worried by that because my time horizon is about 18 months to 2 years, let's say. So, you know, I think it's good. I think you're probably right. It probably comes lower. I don't think it goes as low as people expect. But if it does, then I think there's an opportunity for people to buy it. And I think putting it within some sort of framework will help people understand it. Again, I'm not entirely sure that if, let's say, this quad four plays out for an extended period of time, call it 6 months, 9 months, that Bitcoin continues to fall within it, because I think it looks through, you know, fiscal stimulus and monetary expansion. So yeah. I don't know. Let's wait and see. But, you know, for me, it's just a buying opportunity.
I mean, I think longer term, the particularly, guys, if you show, I think it's slide 96, the long-term chart of the U.S. dollar, you know, broad, you can see that if this is the moment in time where the U.S. government is finally just not even trying to hide it anymore, combining the weaponry of the Treasury with of course, the Fed, print it and spend it as far as the eye can see, and it's like 2000, 2001, the beginning of a broad global decline in dollars against everything else, Bitcoin bulls should be absolutely like hair on fire, electrified, excited about that.
And I don't think that there is a dollar decline coming yet. I mean, I still think there's another spike to come in the dollar. I think we did note in the past that both gold and Bitcoin rallied when the dollar strengthened, not through the whole period, but it did overall. But I think that I'm very interested in the fact that I think the dollar can go higher, as you do. And then maybe the dollar turns. If the dollar does turn, well, then you're going to get a faster accumulation of returns in gold and Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the reasons why I think this is a kind of an 18-month play or so. Let's wait and see.
How do you how debatable is the, because I totally appreciate and understand the difference. I always call it duration mismatch. That's all it is. I'm making a short-term decision versus my intermediate to long-term setup. But again, I have a lot of things that I can buy. I'm not wed. I'm wed to one wife and no macro position. So you know, when I think about this longer-term view. And how you came up with a longer term price that's a pretty high price, but other people have much higher prices. Like, how is that debate? Because I'm really, and as the Bitcoin community would rightly acknowledge, I'm clueless. Like, I have no idea. Like, I'm the dumbest macro person on the earth. So I couldn't dare come up with like the price that this thing could actually go to. I actually don't know what any price can go to.
Your framework is very different to that kind of theoretical macro forecasting that some of us do. You know, my job is to live in the future. Your job is to analyze what's going on right now and how that might affect, let's say, the next 3-month period. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to something that's new and powerful and different and has a unique set of dynamics, it gets a lot of macro people very interested. You know, it's like when you get given the Chinese economy in the mid-90s or the rise of India, you know, these big, huge macro trends, they become something where you can kind of live in the future a bit. Now, none of us know where the price is going, but, you know, just simple kind of analysis of whether it's price action, you know, regression charts, or a whole number of different ways you can look at this, stock to flow ratios, all point to something really gigantically big. And that's what interests me. If it was, you know, a 10% rally here and there, I'm not interested. You know, as you say, there's tons of ways I can make that money if I can, if I get things right. But for me, it's a 25, 50x opportunity. And that's why I don't trade it.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that, so how would, I think you've talked about it in terms of the pipes and the flow, like anything. I mean, if you want to have something more broadly adopted. And gold, you know, let's not forget, it's taken 5,000 years for it to get to 1% of total global asset allocation. So it's a tough fight. But to get Bitcoin to 0.25% or 0.5% or where gold is currently, you know, what do you think is happening or needs to continue to happen?
Well, look, Keith, you know, the community that you and I know, almost every single hedge fund manager I know has it PA, right? You're a classic example. You're somebody, you've had it in your own portfolio, right? So yeah, you're comfortable with the idea of owning it. We don't know what it's going to be yet, but you're comfortable, right? Everybody I know owns a bit of it. Now, their hedge funds couldn't own it yet.
Right.
But the US just changed regulation. So basically, they've said that the US banks can custody it, which is code word for prime broking. Mm-hmm. So prime broking's coming for Bitcoin. That makes a big difference. That allows everybody to get access to it. Then we know that the ETF is coming. So the ETF will come whenever it comes, next 6 months, next 12 months, whatever it is. When it does, the RIA community is now free to buy it. And that's a game changer as well. Because as you know, everybody acts like sheep. If the price starts rising and the market cap of Bitcoin goes up, more people will be forced in. We're also seeing the same thing with endowments and pension funds. It's currently a $200 billion asset. So really, it's kind of a speck of dust in terms of asset classes, as you rightly point out. But once it gets to about $1 trillion, it starts to become interesting to more and more people.
Yeah.
Now, once you start attracting that institutional capital, it just goes up more. I think the market is structurally short upside in Bitcoin. The more it goes up, the more people need to own it. And I like that reflexive nature of this particular setup. I think it's unique to see something like this. The last time I saw anything like this was when Goldman brought out the GSCI commodity index back in the late 90s. Nobody had an allocation, and they went around basically and taught people how to have an allocation and what it does to their portfolios in commodities. And over time, you know, commodities went from zero allocation to hundreds of billions and then trillions of dollars. And I think that whole process is playing out here. I just don't think the Bitcoin community yet speak the language of the pension funds, for example, you know, those Barra risk models and all of that stuff. It's a different language. So they don't really understand the kind of frothing at the mouth, bullish, this is the future. They just want to know the portfolio diversification effects over the long run, what it does to their volatility, what it does to all that kind of stuff. And until the Bitcoin community is not speaking that language, it won't get fully adopted, but it's coming.
Yeah, I think people like me, and certainly like you, I mean, you definitely have thought this through. I mean, we can help with that. I mean, but again, to get the big price, the big flow, wouldn't it be great to be able to, you know, actively short Bitcoin? That's, to me, one major problem. Like, I mean, that's something that can create more upside, right? Because you get people that are too bearish on assets that can go up.
So don't get confused by what you see on the, there's a bunch of tribes in this space. The Bitcoin maximalists are these holders who won't do anything else, right? Everything else is sacrilegious.
I love those guys.
There is a whole lot of trading that goes on in this space.
Yeah.
There are derivatives. There's tons of people who trade. So you need to filter the noise out between which tribe you've upset that day, because there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, if you ever mention Ethereum, then the Bitcoin maximalists hate you. You know, it all becomes very complicated. So the best thing to do is that and just do what you do.
Yeah, I also like the commodity analogy that you gave with the Goldman Index and the broadening of that as an asset class. I mean, because and here's a question for you. I mean, I think of Bitcoin as a commodity for a lot of different reasons. One of the main reasons that I first started to trade it is because you could trade options. So now I could measure and map it within the lens of price, volume, volatility, not just the surface area of the price. You know how I roll. But is it or is it not a commodity, and why?
What's interesting about it, Keith, it trades like a commodity, as you rightly say. It has the volatility structure of a commodity. But it's a commodity with an application. We've never had anything like this before, right? You know, copper has some application, silver has some application, but this has a potential future application which is much larger. So I always think of it as, a reserve asset. I really like it as how it's constructed, what it does, what it represents. But I also think of it as a call option on the future. And that's when it gets really interesting to me, because I don't need to know what that future is, what the future financial system looks like, how blockchain can help this, how Bitcoin fits into this. But I know that that option is probably priced at zero. And that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the optionality here is very clear. I think that like people quibble, whether or not, that sounds a little bit more like how you would have said or how you would have defined or characterized gold, correct? I mean, as a reserve.
No, because gold doesn't have a future upside in terms of it's not a technological application layer on top, right? So Bitcoin is a platform as well as a reserve asset. I've never seen anything like it. Gold, you can't do much more with. You know, it's been around, as you point out, for thousands of years. There's no financial system architecture that's going to come around it that's based around technology and the ability to do different things that we haven't imagined. You know, we know that there's large parts of the financial system that are structurally broken as the debt bubble gets bigger and bigger and bigger. We've got problems with custody and rehypothecation, and who owns what, and the recorded ownership, and the transfer of assets, and all of this stuff. So Bitcoin offers you potential solutions for all of that. I mean, if you note that the central bank digital coins are coming, now that's an interesting conversation in itself, and what that's representing, and what they're gonna be able to do with that. Like, they'll be able to give you and I different interest rates, stuff like that. It's gonna be quite different. And they're gonna reinvent how monetary policy works, and maybe even get rid of that bridge between, you know, the banks, the central bank, the banks, and then the public. Bitcoin fits within all of that too, because it becomes seamless. It becomes a payments layer for the whole internet as well. So again, I think the market prices almost all of that at zero probabilities. Ethereum is almost entirely just that. But I think that is where the potential future value is, outside of the gold style value. Now, gold is an $11 trillion asset. No reason but why Bitcoin couldn't be that. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a long way from here. But if it really is a future system too, well, it could be a much bigger asset. It could be a proper asset, which is, you know, 100, you know, 50 trillion, et cetera. But yeah, again, I'm not talking about next week. I'm talking about 10, 15 years time. And at that point, it's crystal ball gazing. We don't know. But all I'm saying as an ex-derivative guy is I think that option's priced too cheap.
Yeah, I mean, and for those of us that want to own it in any quad but quad four, you know, I still think it's quad four today, but it's down today. I could buy some. There's no rule against that, right? You can be exposed to the longer term.
Also, Yeah, I mean, also what's interesting is you said there's options, right? And these options trade at huge. I mean,
they're great.
It's a highly volatile asset. People can sell puts into this to acquire Bitcoin lower because you're selling, you know, high volatility options, 80 vol or whatever they are now. Mm. I mean, that's a great opportunity. If you're really bullish and you believe, as you say, that the market can pull back, sell puts.
Exactly. I mean, that's down. That's why I can't wait for you to be right on not only, you know, prime brokering availability on that, but the ETF, because the ETF trading options would be really good for me too, because that's what I do. You know, so I would love nothing more than to be in any other quad and buying Bitcoin options, call options. I mean, I wanted, like Diego just walked this through. A lot of people, you know, are uncomfortable with that. I'm absolutely comfortable with that. So that to me would be a really good one too. It actually happened to me, Raul, when I went bullish on commodities in May and June. I started buying these bloody commodity, like corn and soy. And the things, the volume, I didn't know Hedgeye Nation, you know, was as batshit crazy as some of the hodlers, but we're all nuts, you know? So the volume like quintuples the minute that we hit the button on these bloody things, because commodities were shot for dead. They're on 5-year lows. So there really is an impactful flow to the trade when you have people with process that can help have you conviction risk managing the trade. And to me, that was a totally different thing. Like, I had the founders of these bloody ETFs calling me, and I'm like, dude, I don't know, and don't get married to me because I'm going to short you at some point too.
I tell you what, I started a agricultural commodity hedge fund back in, when was it, 2007. In that commodity run as ags were taking off. And I thought it was a macro trade and it was tradable. And then suddenly weather happens and then credit events happen and you forget how difficult these things. People need to be careful in some of these commodities because you can be trapped in a limit down market. We've seen it in lumber recently. Yeah. You can get trapped in a limit down market for days on end and never get a stop loss out. I mean, they're terrifying to trade.
Yeah, that's why I love it. I mean, it's like, I love volatility. I love uncertainty.
I mean, I even had, even talking about the ETFs, I had an ETN in the UK listed on ags. I can't remember what it, I think it was a wheat one, and there was a corn one and a soy one. So I had these back in 2007. Lehman went bust in 2008. And what I thought was an equity, you know, an ETF, wasn't. It was a swap owned by Lehman, and it was all worth zero.
So they
defaulted on it.
Yeah, doing the due diligence terrifying. On these ETFs, that's terrifying, not knowing what's inside the ETF. I don't transact in ETFs unless we obviously do the work. But I think that for people that really want to get into Real Vision or Hedgeye for that matter, you know, it's a go anywhere. There are a lot of other things that we pay attention to, you know, growth and inflation in particular. And there's a lot of, you know, we have 100, and I think it's Raul, I think we have 174, I have to check with Darius on it, 174 ETFs in our model that we could at any given time buy or sell. And those would be ones that we would say, you know, we think that the volatility and price characteristics reflect what we think we're trading. It is what we thought it was. Now, of course, that's not always 100% true because we don't know until we know. But you're broadening the landscape. You're democratizing the base. You're taking...
That's so important.
That's a super important thing.
I mean, it's so important, Keith, because a lot of people approach investing as discrete individual trades.
Yeah.
And both you and I spent a long time trying to teach a framework and then portfolio construction. Because all of these things, it's really important to get these things together. Because if not, you're trading discrete things and you don't really understand what you're doing. But to be a professional in this market, or to give yourself a better probability of being right over time, is, as you say, is understand a framework for investing, understand your time horizons, and, you know, and think about portfolio effects. Once you get those things, the game becomes significantly easier.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many components to the game. Again, as Diego and you just reminded the audience, I mean, this is a hard game. It's really hard. And that's why, you know, I personally have a hard time just buying and holding a macro exposure. And I've always had that problem. I got problems. I mean, everybody can see that. I got more problems than Time Magazine probably at this point on the content front. But, I mean, it's like... what I want to go back to, just a separate topic, but it's all interconnected. And you've been making these points, and this is at least what I think that you and I are both seeing in terms of this non-V-shaped recovery. You made the point the other day, I think you tweeted about the core, you know, the interrelationship between crude, bank stocks, et cetera, the bond market, which you call the truth teller. I think that's what you call it. You know, what is it about that that today all of a sudden it matters again?
You know, it's not, you know, this is a narrative business, as you know, and it's difficult to know why that narrative shifts. But what made it a very interesting market to me is there was one narrative, which was NASDAQ up every day.
Yeah.
There was another narrative, which was banks and a whole bunch of other things. Bonds were telling you the opposite at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very interesting to me because it rarely happens. I mean, we've never seen, I don't think, gold miners outperform banks by 85% in 6 months. I mean,
that was awesome.
Stunning.
That was fantastic.
And when I look at it, when I step back and construct my macro framework, I look at it and think, okay, this is something to do with debt. It's to do with insolvency, because if you look at anything like General Electric, Ford, AT&T, anything with old economy debts, or whether it's emerging market FX, looks the same. Oil, there's a lot of debt-laden stuff there. They all look like that. And that actually looks like the real-time economic data, which was it fell, it rallied, it flattened out, and it's starting to roll a bit as you know the COVID lockdowns and the lack of stimulus and all the other things go on. So they seem pretty truthy to me. And the bond market just kind of stuck its fingers up and said, we're no interested in your narrative. We don't think this is going anywhere. And I always take the bond market seriously. It's very rare there's big dislocations in the bond market. The last time I ever saw that was really 1994. It's very rare there's a big narrative mismatch. So the bond market to me tells me something, which is, listen, growth and inflation are not coming back. Sure, you might get passing phases where the narrative shifts, but the underlying structure, the bond market's shouting to us that is not the case. And I still think that rates are going to go negative. Don't forget, we've just seen the UK go negative. Everyone said, oh, that's impossible. Well, it wasn't impossible because the 2-year gilts went negative first and the Bank of England will follow. And we will see, I think, 2-year US treasuries go negative and the Fed will follow. We saw that with ECB. German Schatz went negative 18 months before the ECB went negative, you know, quite a few years ago.
Yeah.
So I think this is still coming. I think that bond market trend is still in place.
Well, I think a lot of macro tourists have that issue. They're navel-gazing, and now navel-gazing with a political view. You know, don't forget that a lot of people, this whole new blue wave narrative of, it used to be if Biden wins, we're going to get taxed and we're screwed, but now it's a blue wave is beautiful and buy stocks. I mean, it's amazing how the narratives change. This morning in my early look, I actually rattled off the 6 different reasons why stocks were up yesterday, and not one of them had a number in them. They were all just narratives, you know. So narratives and participation, how about that, Raul? I mean, you and I are, you know, we are the recipients of this. Let's be clear. You know, more people participating in markets is good for Raul, and it's good for Crazy KM here, who's the Bitcoin wrong tweet, okay? But all these people participating have a lot of emotion to what they're doing, and on the edges of the volume are really having impact. 15 to 20% are, by our numbers, Citadel's numbers, that's the daily flow that they affect when it was pretty much like inside of 5% or less prior to that. What do you think about that? And how it's actually, you know, we just did in the bond market, we just for like 3 days had one of these episodic non-trending sell-offs in treasuries to buy. There have been 3 of them since the beginning of the year, March, June, and this one. I have to believe that the retail community participating there on, you know, wrongly, making the wrong decision at the wrong time, had to have a huge impact too.
You know, I'm kind of interested in this is people coming into financial markets new. I think that's a good thing. It got pretty stale a couple of years ago because there was almost no participation. Now, obviously, we all have to learn the hard way. So it makes you look like a hero for a while. Everyone had calls on the upside in Tesla. Everyone looks like a god. And then the market turns against you and you look like a fool. But usually what happens is you then step back and go, well, why did that go wrong? And then you start to do the work. And once you start doing the work and understanding your process and what you do and how markets work and how economies work, then I think that it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing to see more participation. It's a bad thing that it's so narrative driven. And that's, I think, a function of stuff like Twitter, where narratives catch headlines much faster than doing homework does. But I think over time, hopefully, people will do more homework on what they're doing. And that's only a good thing.
No, it's a very good thing, in particular, like I said, for you. I mean, you're the educator. You're the disruptor. You have the content that people can look at objectively and say, well, whether I agree or disagree with that person, they're at least getting the airtime without a commercial to explain what it is that they do and why. I mean, that's a hugely valuable asset. I can't believe that 50 to 70 million new retail, quote unquote, accounts aren't willing to be educated, particularly if they're being forced to through loss of capital.
Well, right now, they don't know that they need to be educated, but they will be, as you say, through loss of capital.
Right. Yeah.
Right, because let's be absolutely brutally honest. I mean, retail outperformed every hedge fund manager in the last 6 months. So, you know, retail did well. But again, I think the process of winning, then losing is a good process for everybody. You've gone through it. I've gone through it. Our careers will always have it in it. There's no way of ever avoiding it. It's part of the business. But if it does get you to do homework, then places like Real Vision or HedgeEye, you know, people come to it and realize, okay, there is a different way. And I think that's super important. And that makes me incredibly bullish on this whole space. I think financial market education, I think, is a really big factor that's going to be driving us forwards. And I think even the rise of cryptocurrencies, which got retail investors much earlier than everybody else, is a very good thing because it's getting people to understand all of this stuff.
100%. I mean, and having a live debate, a live wire, again, we beat the Bitcoin thing to dead pulp here. But I mean, I love that. You know, that was fun. You know, I'm not like, you know, I get in fights all the time on Twitter. I've been doing it for years, a decade, more than a decade. That's good. I mean, we do.
Yeah, none of us has a monopoly on the truth. I mean, however strongly your opinion may come across, you have to be humble, because anybody who's lasted this long in financial markets learns humility. Because 100%. I always say, if you think your shit smells of roses, you're about to get your nose rubbed in it.
Well, if you want to see shit, you can look at all my shitty trades since 2008, because every single one of them's timestamped. They're there, and that's actually why I did it, because I wanted to be less shitty, Raul. That's really always my goal.
I did the same. I mean, Global Macro Investors timestamped every trade since 2005.
Yeah.
Same. So it's all there.
Because you solicit an opinion when you're wrong, or when they think you're wrong. And then an objective person, I think you and I are both, you're going to sit there and weigh that against what your prior. I mean, it's not that complicated.
I see a lot of people get paralyzed by counter narratives. So I can see it in the dollar. You know, people don't want to take a view because they hear a seductive narrative from the dollar bulls and a seductive narrative from the dollar bears, and they get paralyzed. They want to hear endless debate. In the end, our job is, as you say, weigh it up and take the fucking view. price will then tell you if you're right or wrong.
Yeah.
And that's what people keep saying, the dollar, you know. I'm like, I don't care anymore. I've debated this. I've made my case. If I get stopped out, I'm wrong. If I make money, I'm right.
Yeah.
In the end, the market will tell me.
Yeah, I love that. And having communication and content platforms like ours is certainly going to help perpetuate the discussion and the learning process. You couldn't have done this 20 years ago. You know, so like you said, the retail community kind of went away. They were here 20 years ago. Now they're back and they're empowered with the bloody information. That is super powerful, right? It's not calling up MotleyFool.com and saying, hey, they got an internet connection with the 200-day moving monkey on it. I mean, that used to be considered edge, right? Because human beings can't calculate the bloody 200-day on their own in their own head. Now my 4-year-old can do that.
Yeah, I mean, you and I know what we've essentially done is give people access to the kind of research and information that only the most elite people in the world had. Right? This is a huge change. People never got this information. It only came to hedge fund managers or, you know, sovereign wealth funds and these big players who paid huge amounts of money for it. And now it's changed. you know, this world used to be run by shitty newsletters written by people who've never actually operated in financial markets and charged people, made them terrified, and then sold newsletters and churned them. I mean, but this is changing. This is real, meaningful information we're trying to give people now. And I'm really proud of what we've both done.
Yeah, it's empowering. I mean, and it's and the community, our communities, like, to be clear, you know, you said I kicked the wrong bee's nest. I mean, God help those who kicked the Hedgeye or Real Vision bee's nest, especially if it's Ral Paul. I mean, people, that's what happens, right? It's like Otto. They just go after the poor guy, the old wall guy. I mean, I feel bad for the old wall guy. He's tweeting there from like somewhere in Palm Beach after coming out of Raymond James, having a big lunch. It's like, oh my God, you just got crushed. Okay. All right, we're going to get you have a big audience, obviously, and there are a lot of good questions in here. My last question, though, just to finish on this topic, Raul, is, you know, just if you will, and this is obviously totally up to you, but if you give people a sneak into what, you know, the future of Bitcoin, I have no bloody idea, obviously. But I think you have a pretty good idea of the future of Real Vision and when what it is the future state could look like. Like, what are some of the most exciting things you're working on that people may not see yet?
So we're transitioning from just being a content provider. You know, we create the world's best financial video content. It's fantastic what we've managed to achieve.
Agreed.
But that's really just part of the mission. You know, we've just launched a community called The Exchange, and that's got tens of thousands of people already interacting meaningfully. So it's not short form Twitter. This is long form stuff where people are posting videos, analysis, research, all of this stuff. So we're building that out. We're also layering education. So we've got lots of education offerings coming. And then there's a whole bunch of other communities we're going to be building onto this, along with a broader B2B offering as well. So there's a huge amount to come out of Real Vision, probably over the next 3 to 6 months. People understand the scale of the ambitions that we have to help as many people in the financial world as possible, from the investment banks through to the beginner. And everybody in the middle.
That's awesome. I mean, more collaboration, more interaction means more education, faster, faster, faster. You know, you're either going to get educated by loss of capital or by just paying attention or both.
Also, Keith, the old world was Bloomberg. You paid for a Bloomberg terminal, paid $25,000 a year. I'm looking at my Bloomberg now. You pay $25,000 a year for it, and everybody else doesn't get access.
Right.
Well, we're trying to do that the opposite way around now. We're trying to say, okay, fine, whatever you can afford, we'll find something for you. We'll bring you communities. We'll give you free content. But we're going to help give you the power of understanding, to understand what's going on. By getting somebody like you on the platform and you give your whole philosophy and thesis and how you see things, that just adds so much value to people. So, yeah, there's a lot to come on this.
Yeah, it's the old tower in the square. The people in the square are starting to be able to see. It's amazing what happens when that happens. And I have a feeling that those who had privileged inside information or not that ran hedge funds over the years are going to be replaced by the people in the square and replaced by good process. So that's what I've thought for a long, long time.
I call it the hive mind. Is, you know, from your subscribers and our subscribers, we've got some of the smartest people in the world. They just do different things. So they may not be a financial market professional,
exactly,
but they know something. And when you create conversation and ask them, hey, what do you think is going on in the airline industry? You'll have 30 people go, well, I do this in the airline industry and this is how I see it playing out. That's amazing. Yeah. That's the kind of information the best hedge funds in the world paid tens of thousands of dollars for. It's free now. It's our audience.
Mm-hmm. I love that. All right, let's get some questions here. Let's see. What asset classes? Actually, this is from the prior. So we have some questions that have to do with the prior discussion. Here's one for Raul. Raul, do you see Bitcoin as a commodity like Keith does, or more like a real store of value and potential medium of exchange like gold? Thanks for the interview, guys. I think you've pretty much answered that. Unless there's something else you'd like to add, Raul. It's got a lot of votes.
No, I think it trades like a commodity. I think it trades like a commodity. It's becoming a true store of value. I think its opportunity is to become the world's most pristine asset. It's not there yet because its volatility looks too much like a commodity.
Yep.
But it's coming.
Mike from Toronto, thanks for telling us where you're from, Mike. The Leafs, by the way, man, they've upgraded some good signings. That's been a very bad situation to be a fan of that team. What would make you change your view on the U.S. dollar, Ralph?
This is the question I get. Price.
Yeah, it's the first time you've been asked it. I know you might feel a little uncomfortable. Go for it.
Price.
Yeah.
If I've got my view. I've got a structural view. I've got a framework. I've developed it over years. I've been in the dollar on and off, in and out for a long time. I remain long dollars, and I still think that it goes much further than people expect. But if I'm wrong, Price will tell me. I got pretty close to getting out recently. But I didn't, and it's a long-term trade, and you know I don't trade around it as much as you would do, Keith. Maybe I should have done. I would have had some better returns in it, but hey ho, it is what it is.
Yeah, that's one where I often get characterized as shorter term because I'm here every day and I tweet every day. But you know my intermediate full investing cycle, I think people can appreciate that. Those can last two. In the case of the dollar, I went bullish in the middle of 2018, and I got out of it in May of 2020. That's not like a trade. I traded up with the bullish bias for the whole time. But what I was really doing was just preparing for what we call quad three. And now back to quad four, it's back to long the dollar. The other thing there, Raul, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, on the dollar, but I definitely do. I mean, the cross, when you look at cross asset class volatility and you look at FX vol in particular, I mean, it has spiked meaningfully here in the last month. And that is not a sell signal on the dollar because, of course, it's the vol of all the other currencies that is rising.
Yes. Also, as you know, I take it very seriously with either bond vol picks up or currency vol, because right, they're infectious. If you get currency vol, it tends to infect other asset classes. So, you know, really monitor it. And I know you look at the vol, and it's a good way to see the kickoff of what's happening, but take it seriously.
Yeah, slide 61, guys, you can see the what we call the angst on display. And they do, you know, it's FX vol and currency vol. That are FX fall and rates fall, rather, that are spiking. And that's what happened in September. And that's really, September was a very interesting month. I mean, if you were a hodler of the NASDAQ, you would be quite upset about what happened in September. That was a 13% drawdown in a New York minute. Do you have any thoughts about that, the bubbliness of it all or not? I have my views on the bubble.
Look, it reminds me a lot of, when I was running a hedge fund back in 2001, it reminds me a lot of that. Rising vol, rising markets.
Yes.
That's usually a warning sign that something's going on. Rising vol, rising markets, you tend to start eking out top patterns that are very difficult to trade. It's really not a market for widows and orphans. So once I start seeing stuff like that, I tend to be cautious. I won't short it and I won't be long it either. It's something that you start to observe. I think that if the market breaks, then, there's some easier trades to be done than shorting equities overall, particularly something like the NASDAQ. But, we also saw the amount of speculative activity that I've not seen since that 99, 2000, 2001 period. It was spectacular to see, both with SoftBank and their billions of dollars of call buying and retail as well.
Buying for
splits.
When
that happens, you pay attention.
Buying for stock splits. That was a new one for me. Here's a question from Nate. And I'm not, apologies, I'm not familiar with this conversation that you had. So assuming you had it, how much did your conversation, Raul, with Jeff Booth change your projection on immediate deflation versus immediate term inflation?
I've been a deflationist for a long time. I think we're structurally deflating. We'll continue to do so. As you point out, the narrative can shift to inflationary periods. That's okay. But structurally, the chart goes top left, bottom right, and it hasn't changed. So Jeff Booth's developed my thinking about deflationary wages, which I'm doing some work on for Global Macro Investor now, which I think will be a new perspective on it. And that came out of the conversation I had with Jeff. But other than that, I've always been a deflationist. I don't think this trend is over. I think demographics, technology, and debt just keep inflation lower.
Well, this look at slide 74, guys. This is high yield debt to cash flow or domestic corporate debt to GDP, these charts. I'm just going to laugh. I mean, can you see these charts? Yeah, I think you know these charts, obviously. But, I mean, these are funny charts.
These are...
Go for it.
It's madness, right? But what's interesting is high yield. Well, bonds, corporate bonds, don't price any economic risk any longer because of the Fed. So it's a weird old world where you've got, you know, insolvency issues, but the bonds actually don't trade that way, but the equity does. And I've noticed that in the past in the European banking sector, you know, the European banks, their bonds don't price anything like the risk that the equities price because the ECB is there buying the bonds. And it's the same now with the Fed buying corporate bonds, but equities price in a very different risk indeed. You know, I think the equity of General Electric is going to go pretty close to zero. The bonds probably won't show that risk. Now, you might have a jump to default risk eventually, but it's all coming out in the equity market first.
Yeah, this is clear and present danger to many. This last question here, I could ask all the questions. There's a lot of votes. You have you're the top vote getter so far today, Raul, for your questions.
Thank you. And
this one does not have to do with Bitcoin. With the amount of debt held, this is from Emma in the UK. So, with the amount of debt held by central banks, can real yields be allowed to rise? If yes, what are the implications? If no, how do they prevent it?
I don't think the central bank has any ability to control these things. They think they do, but they don't.
Great.
If not, we wouldn't have had the business cycles. We wouldn't have business cycles. We wouldn't have falling inflation. We wouldn't have any of the things that people think that the central banks can stop. I worry about rising real yields caused by deflation. I think this next quarter, and I think you're probably on the same page, we might see headline inflation go negative. I think real yields may go up, which is the big horror, right? Real yields go up because of deflation. When interest rates are at zero, you're pretty screwed. That's been the big fear from central banks all along, is this situation. The ECB's in this mess now. Inflation's gone negative. Rates are already negative, whatever. What the hell do they do?
Mm-hmm.
This is a really, really difficult situation. The thing the central banks always feared the most.
I mean, that's it's interesting, and we'll end on that. But your major risk is the same risk that Perea outlined, and he said specifically, he says we went from risk-free interest to interest-free risk at the zero bound. And it's a really, I don't know. I think their answer, though, I think it's this book. I think that's the, I mean, obviously that is the answer, the next play, right?
Of course it is, but the question is, Keith, is does it actually generate inflation? Imagine if it doesn't.
If MMT does not, right. You mean if MMT doesn't create inflation?
Yeah, then you've got a gigantic debt default because you've got all this debt. And as everybody needs to understand, is debt plus deflation is a ticket to bankruptcy because your real debt goes up every year. And this is the big issue when you're this much in debt. What that really means is you don't have enough cash flow to service your debts. So if MMT does not generate inflation, then we've got a really big problem.
Major, major, huge, tremendously huge. I can't even exaggerate how big that problem would be. I'm indebted to you, by the way.
No, the market...
go ahead.
The market will trade the narrative. The market will trade the narrative of inflation from MMT. But let's wait and see. I'm not entirely convinced. And that'll be a story for another day. Obviously, this is not a story for this year or probably even next year. But after that, let's see.
Yeah, let's see. I mean, let's see. I was going to say, and I'm still going to say it again. I mean, I'm indebted to you. I mean, you make me think about things that I don't think about all the time. And this conversation did not disappoint. We started with a topic that, you know, I think I'm obviously totally confused. I need some help. So I got some help. And we're going to see what I do with that. We'll see. Right, Raul? I guess that's the story for both of us. We'll see what happens next. Thanks. Thanks for spending the time, man.
Just don't be too cute with your Bitcoin.
I'm not cute. Not yet. I don't even think my mom's cute anymore. All right. We'll be back with the next Neil Howe and John Malden. We got two of them at the same time.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. As a reminder, new Hedgeye subscribers may qualify for a special discount on one of our Hedgeye investing products. Email customer service director Matt Moran at mmoran@hedgeye.com. That's MMORAN@hedgeye.com.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.